And as she does, she's listening raptly to what I have to say. So, as I said, I'm a faculty member at Union College. Perhaps more relevant for this setting, I'm also a blogger. I have a weblog that I maintain called Uncertain Principles. Here's a screenshot of it, and I'll talk more about this as I go on through the talk. Just to sort of put things in context, here's the graphic that Sabine showed, showing the relationships between science, society, and information technology. What am I going to be talking about here? I'm sort of talking about ways, you know, to look at the communication between science and a larger society, and really what information technology has to offer to improve that communication. So sort of bringing all three of these elements into play. Now, when I was invited to do this, the title of the talk and the topic, the general topic, came to me immediately. But there were two ways I could go with this. I thought one possibility would be I could just try and tell charming and funny stories about the dog and about the blog and that sort of thing. Or I could try to be provocative. And I said, well, you know, I don't usually give this sort of talk, so I'll just, you know, I could do it either way. I'll just wait and see what everyone else is going to do. And then I got the program and discovered that I was giving the second talk on the first day. So you get the provocative version, because I had to make a decision about one or the other, and I figure it's good to for kicking off the meeting, it's good to be a little provocative. So to start off the provocative statement, I'll sort of set up the recent problem. And I'm a physicist and an American, so most of my examples through this will involve physics and the United States. And in particular, this past December, there was a major crisis in high energy physics in the United States when the Congress passed an omnibus budget bill for fiscal year 2008 that dramatically slashed funding for high energy physics, particularly things funded through the Department of Energy. The Fermi Lab that maintains the one big accelerator still in the US had its funding cut from $372 million to $320 million. Development funding for the International Linear Collider, a device that's envisioned as sort of a follow-on machine for the Large Hadron Collider that's starting up this week. The ILC development funding was cut to $15 million from $60 million. This is particularly bad because this took place in December, which is 3 months into the fiscal year, so they had already spent a quarter of their expected allocation, or about $15 million, which basically shut the program down for the rest of the year. And funding for for ITER, the International Thermoelectric Reactor, was completely eliminated, $160 million cut out of the budget entirely. And as I said, most of my examples will be from the United States, but lest you think this is just an American problem, there were very similar deep cuts in physics funding in the UK at around the same time that have again, led to the premature shutdown of some very good experiments. This was all DOE, yes. So I think really the reason things like NSF and NIST didn't get affected as much as their budgets had been passed before this omnibus bill went through. So they had already gotten their funding in another way. So the obvious question to ask about this sort of major funding crisis is, whose fault is it? Who do we blame for this? And there are sort of two obvious targets in the United States, one being President George Bush, and the argument being that, you know, starting irresponsible foreign wars and making dramatic tax cuts used up all the money that we ought to be spending on science. Some other people have argued that it's actually the fault of Democrats in Congress. This fellow here is Senator Harry Reid. This is Representative Nancy Pelosi. They're the leaders of the legislative branch. And some people argue that the funding cuts resulted from sort of grandstanding on the part of the Democrats and trying to send some sort of message that they're in charge and can cut whatever they like. But I'd like to, you know, my provocative statement to start this off is I would like to make the claim that the real blame for this lies with us as a scientific community. My claim is that this funding was cut for scientific research because in a fundamental way, we have failed at our job as scientists. as a community of scientists and researchers, we have failed to do our job properly, and that's why funding ended up being cut. All right, so that's a provocative statement, and it also, if I say we're failing at our job as scientists, I'm obviously presuming some sort of definition of what is our job as scientists. So let me give you my sort of somewhat idiosyncratic picture of what our job is. Our job as scientists is to do science, and what is science? Science is really a process for learning about the world, a process for building up reliable information about how the world works. And it has four steps, the first of which is just to look at the world and find something that you want to explain. Right? At its most fundamental level, the essence of science consists of somebody looking at something and saying, I wonder why that happens. All right? You look at the world, find something that you wonder why it happens, and then the next step is you make up some sort of theory. You develop a model to explain why that thing might happen. And then from there, you go on, you test your theory, you design some experiments, you carry out experiments, you make some further observations to see if reality agrees with your model of why things happen. And the final step is to tell everyone about it. Right? And this final step here, right, step four, is really where most of this conference is going to be focused. It's going to be primarily talking about, new ways of communicating knowledge among the scientific community. And I think this is also where things break down in terms of the funding argument. And this is the step where you publish your results, you disseminate the information widely, and you allow other researchers to replicate what you've done, and that's the key step for moving science forward. As I said, I teach at Union College, which is a small liberal arts school, so since I'm at a liberal arts institution, I'm obliged to provide some humanities content. So I will give you sort of the idiot physicist's version of the history of science, looking at things through these four steps. And the first two steps really go back to antiquity. Right? If you look in the history of Western science, right, the ancient Greeks had down the look at the world and make up a theory part. People like Aristotle, the Pythagoreans, and so on, had down the idea of coming up with theories about how the world works. They had lots of very nice ideas. Many of them were utterly daft. As Bertrand Russell famously remarked, Aristotle maintained that women had fewer teeth than men in spite of the fact that he was married twice. All right? Because there was simply no systematic culture of experiment. It never occurred to him to check, to ask his wife to open her mouth and count how many teeth she had. There was not a systematic culture of testing your theory about how the world works by actually going out and looking at how the world works and seeing if it's right. That part doesn't really come in, at least the Western science, until about, roughly speaking, the 1600s. Contemporaneously in many different sciences. In my own discipline of physics, we tend to give credit for this to Galileo Galilei, who launched the systematic study of mechanics and astronomy in the early 1600s by really solidifying the idea that experiments allow you to distinguish between theories. Right? He famously dropped light and heavy objects off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, possibly, or he definitely rolled light and heavy objects down ramps and showed that they accelerate in the same way, and showed that the acceleration of gravity is approximately constant. And there are roughly contemporary developments in lots of other fields, in medicine, and this is around the time when people first started studying anatomy by actually dissecting human corpses to verify that things were the way that people theorized they were. And so this is really the beginning of what we recognize as modern science. But there's still one more step, and step four really took a surprisingly long time to catch on. As late as the late 1600s, this fellow here, Robert Hooke, as an English physicist, or an English scientist really, he did work in a wide variety of fields, published one of his best-known results in the following form, as CEIIINOSSSSTTUV, right, which is a Latin cryptogram. If you know what to do, you can unscramble this to come up with the phrase ut tensio sic vis, which is Latin for as the extension, so the force, Or this is what we teach to first-year physics students as Hooke's law, F equals minus kx. It says that the force required to stretch some elastic object by some distance is proportional to the distance that you stretch. Okay. Hooke did this. He published it in this bizarre form so as to establish priority for the claim, so that he would get credit for being the first one to come up with this. But he published it in this encrypted manner so that no one else could figure it out, and that he could have a few years' time to be the only one who could build upon this knowledge. All right, this is very much counter to the modern norms of science, which is you make a discovery and then you tell absolutely everyone you know about your discovery. Right? Because what separates science from alchemy is this fourth step. Right? Alchemists, you know, made all sorts of interesting experiments dealing with the basics of chemistry. But they never really accomplished anything because they all jealously guarded their results. What allows the explosion of scientific progress that occurs in the 1700s and 1800s is this idea of sharing knowledge with everyone so that you can build on work that's done by others. In the memorable phrase of Isaac Newton, you can see farther than others because you can stand on the shoulders of giants. Right. Ironically, the shoulders of giants quote was reportedly a shot at Hooke, who was a rival of Newton's and actually a man of very short stature. So the shoulders of giants remark is a dig at him. So this is the essence of science, and it's the explosion in scientific knowledge really doesn't take place until the 1700s, the 1800s, when this becomes established. And the idea of widely disseminating your results really gets nailed down. So historically, you can sort of divide the approach of publishing scientific information into sort of two models. There's two approaches to the problem of disseminating science and scientific information. And I'm going to do some slight violence to the history of science by identifying these two models with their sort of historical progenitors. But this is I'm willing to do a little violence to history. It for the sake of a larger point here. I'll identify these two models with, one is the Sir Isaac Newton, the famous British physicist who pretty much launched the modern study of physics, and the other is Galileo Galilei, who I already mentioned. All right, so we can say there's a Newtonian approach to publishing scientific information, and there's a Galilean approach to publishing scientific information. The Newtonian publication is exemplified by his most famous work, which is the Principia Mathematica. It's a picture of the frontispiece. It's published in 1687. The Principia is written in Latin. It's highly technical. It's highly mathematical. The Latin thing is not as big an obstacle as you might think, because Latin was the lingua franca of science at the time. But the Principia is famously almost unreadable. It's in very dense, complicated Latin. It's a highly technical work. It's highly mathematical. It relies upon extremely complicated geometric arguments that are very difficult to follow. Newton published this after 20-odd years of work, but it was almost nobody could figure out what he was talking about in a lot of the stuff. And some years later, Newton wrote to a friend that he had actually done this deliberately, that he had deliberately made it as opaque as possible so as to avoid being baited by little smatterers in mathematics. Again, the little smatterers in mathematics is a shot at Hooke. This is a demonstration of the fact that Newton was an absolutely brilliant scientist, but kind of a dick. He made it very hard to read his main work so that he wouldn't have to put up with questions from people who weren't as smart as he was. All right, so he only wanted to deal with questions from people who were already experts themselves and didn't want to have to deal with a larger audience. That's Newtonian publication. In contrast to this, I would say there's Galilean publication. And Galileo's most famous work is probably the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems, discussing the contrast between Copernican and Aristotelian cosmology. Again, here's the picture of the frontispiece. This was published in 1632. Unlike the Principia, Galileo wrote his most famous work in the vernacular, in Italian, and it's presented in a fictional form as an imaginary dialogue between three characters. one who promotes the Copernican system, one who promotes the Aristotelian system, and one who's sort of in between and trying to be convinced by the others. This is, you know, it's published in 1632, so it's not copyrighted. You can find copies of it to read on the internet. It's very accessible. It's highly readable. It's actually, you know, quite funny for in a 1632 kind of way, and it's persuasive. The book was wound up being banned, but it was widely read and influential. So Galileo's approach to science was he presented his results regarding the Copernican system to the widest audience he could. He wrote for the general public to convince, you know, large numbers of people of the rightness of his results. And he made his results as accessible as possible, in contrast to Newton, who made his results deliberately unreadable. Now, you can ask, we have two models here that people have tried for scientific publication, and you can reasonably ask, what are the results of these different publication models? Newton, of course, published the Principia, which was deliberately unreadable. He was made master of the mint. He died a wealthy and powerful man. And now his picture is on British currency. Galileo, on the other hand, published his dialogue so as to be readable by the widest audience possible and got in trouble with the Inquisition. And he died under house arrest. So the lesson of history is clear, which is Newtonian publication is better for your career. Okay, if you want to have a good career, you want to publish like Newton, not like Galileo. And I would argue that, you know, the same basic pattern still holds today. Not so much with the Inquisition, but you're still better off publishing in the Newtonian method. Because, you know, as we know, in science and in science generally and academia specifically, hiring, promotion, and prestige within the community depend on the production of technical publications aimed at a narrow audience of other scientists. Right? If you want to get a tenured job at a good research university, you need to be publishing in science, not Scientific American. Right? And in fact, I would say in many cases, publication in a Galilean mode, publication aimed at a wide audience, a general audience, is, you know, in terms of hiring and promotion and so on, is discounted or even ignored. Even research that's done in sort of a pedagogical vein doesn't really count as much as research that's done and pitched primarily to a narrow audience of other scientists. Right, so what counts for getting you a good job, for keeping your job, for advancing in the field, is publishing it in as technical a manner as possible. Right, which means that to a large degree, professional scientists are not involved in the business of bringing science to the general public anymore. Right, the job of communicating the results of scientific research to the public falls to science writers and journalists, people who have degrees in journalism and English and so forth, and do not necessarily have a strong scientific background. And the job of educating the mass citizenry falls to people who have degrees in education, who again may not have a terribly good scientific background. Professional scientists, for the most part, concern themselves with communicating with other professional scientists because that's the way all the incentives in the modern scientific community run. Now you could say, well, what's wrong with that? It worked pretty well for Newton. What are the bad consequences? Well, the most obvious consequence of this is that public knowledge of science is depressingly bad. And the graph that I show here that may be a little hard to read is it's a bar graph showing the results of a number of science literacy questions that were asked of people in various countries as part of a general knowledge survey and presented in the National Science Foundation's Science and Engineering Indicators Report. A couple of these, the ones that get the most attention are politically charged and so get a lot of press for that. But I'd particularly like to draw your attention to two of these. One is the top here. This question says, true or false, lasers work by focusing sound waves. Right, and if you look at the bars here, you'll find that only 45% of people in the United States who were asked this question answered it correctly. Okay, so 45%, this is a true-false question. So if you just guessed, you would expect about a 50% success rate. So people are essentially guessing blindly.
The differences are they're not ascribable to the subject of your previous slide, which was modes of scientific.
I would say that there are large differences in among countries and among certain questions, but I would say in general all of the levels of all of the answers here are quite bad.
Okay. Even the ones where the
So I would say, you know, less than 50% of Americans know that lasers do not work by focusing sound waves. The other one that I want to highlight is over here. This says, true or false, electrons are smaller than atoms. And again, less than 50%, this one I believe is 48% of Americans answered this question correctly. Again, these are true false questions, and people are essentially guessing at things that, okay, this is appalling. Right, these are things, you know, lasers, right, there's a laser, right, that has nothing to do with sound, right, electrons are components of atoms, it should be obvious that electrons are smaller than atoms, and yet people don't know these facts, right, and lest you think that this is just a statement about the appalling state of the American educational system, this is not just a U.S. problem. I'll note that the United States is among the world leaders in correct answers to these two questions. All right, we're crushing the Japanese in knowing that lasers don't work by focusing sound waves. All right. So now you can say, you know, does it really matter if people know facts about science as long as they have a positive attitude about science? And in fact, you know, the general public likes science. 87% of people surveyed for this report support federal funding of scientific research, and 41% say that we should be spending more on scientific research than we are now. 87% of people say that they're interested in new scientific discoveries, and 47% say they have a lot of interest in new scientific discoveries. So in spite of the fact that they know almost nothing about it, people like science. The problem is they like science when they notice it. Right? Only 15% of people surveyed say that they follow science news very closely. And that comes in 10th place of topics, of news topics that they ask about. To put this into perspective, sports, 23% of people say that they follow sports news very closely. All right, that's killing the number of people who you know, it's 15% for science, 23% for sports. Number one is weather. 50% of people very closely follow news about the weather. So you say, well, what are the consequences of this? The consequences are that the public favors funding science, but it's not a high priority. It's not something that's really on their radar screen on a regular basis. And this leads to a great deal of instability, a sort of feast or famine atmosphere for science funding. That if you could come up with some sort of attention-grabbing crisis, you can get lots of money. You can get support for lots of funding, but then people tend to lose interest once the crisis passes. As an example of this, I show here, this graph is the budgets for the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation over the last 20 years. And you can see this inflection point here. In 1998, President Bill Clinton pledged to double the budget of the National Institutes of Health over the next 5 years. And in fact, they carried through with this promise over the next 5 years. You can see that the NIH budget approximately doubles. But then, you know, up here in the latter part, after they finished doubling the budget, they lost interest. And funding for the NIH has gone flat in subsequent years. Right? And this has produced severe problems for a lot of people who work in the biomedical sciences, whose work is funded by the NIH, because you know, they had this dramatic increase in funding, and suddenly that increase is cut off. And this, you know, creates major problems for institutions that have come to rely on the support of NIH grants. All right, suddenly the number of grants is shrinking. The money situation is tightening, and it's causing problems. So this is an example of how, you know,
these are not inflation adjusted.
These are not inflation adjusted.
So flat means
flat actually means going down slightly.
Right, that's the point.
Yeah. This is an example of how, you know, people generally support increasing science funding. Clinton's pledge in 1998 was very popular, and you know, people were all in favor of this, and then they lost interest immediately. And it can be even worse than this. In this case, they carried through with it. In 2002, President George Bush, in his State of the Union address, pledged to double the funding of the National Science Foundation. And they actually passed a budget that allowed, that authorized the NSF to double their funding. That's this upward going line here. The bars here represent the actual NSF budget for the subsequent years. And you can see that while the initial pledge to double the NSF budget, you know, was announced with a great deal of fanfare, was very popular with the public, nobody bothered to follow through on it. All right, the funding for the NSF, this graph is a couple of years old. The 2007 level is about there. The 2008 level is about there. In fact, if you look at the numbers adjusted for inflation, the NSF budget has actually dropped each of the last 2 years, which is the first time in the history of the agency that its budget has decreased in real dollars in two consecutive years. So what I would argue here is, why did Congress slash high energy physics funding in 2008? They cut funding because they could. All right? Cuts to scientific funding for scientific research are essentially without consequences, because there is no large, consistent, vocal constituency demanding funding for scientific research. Scientists are all for it, but there's not that many of us. You can drum up emergency support in these crisis situations. And in fact, some of the high energy physics funding was restored in an emergency measure earlier this year, after letter writing campaigns and petitions and intense lobbying from groups like the American Physical Society and other organizations.
I just want to point out, just as one of the anecdotes there on your earlier slide, that ITER was zeroed out in that omnibus bill by a single congressional aide who wrote it in and no one saw it. I happen to know this from a friend in Washington. Okay, so it was $160 million
removed
by one congressional aide, unreviewed by anyone else. So, I mean, it's that.
Yeah, exactly. People are not paying attention to it. It's not high on anybody's priority list. And so, you know, these are cuts that you can make because they're not going to pay a price for this, right? Nobody in Congress expects to lose their seat come November because they cut funding for scientific research. Right? You can gain points with the public by proposing increases in scientific research. Everybody likes to hear that. But whether you follow through on those or even cut the funding doesn't really have any real consequences for the legislature. Right. So what to do about this? I would say that as scientists, we need to do a better job of engaging the public's interest and creating that constituency for science, the vocal, consistent push for consistent scientific funding. We need to do a better job of creating that. What we need is more of a Galilean approach to science. We need more people who are professional scientists to work on spreading their knowledge of science and the results of their research to a broader audience, to not focus so much on communicating narrowly with only with other scientists, but to bring this to a broader public and create the constituency that we need to have the funding be consistent. And I would argue that there's an opportunity here, and there's an audience that exists for this sort of thing. If you look at, you know, there are a number of developments in recently that indicate that there is an opportunity here if we're willing to seize it. There is this movement of science cafes, the Café Scientifique, people getting together in bars and restaurants to hear scientists talk about their research. In May of this year in New York City, there was a World Science Festival organized by Brian Greene and Alan Alda and some other celebrities and scientists, put on a week's worth of events about science in New York City, and they sold out every event that they did. They actually added extra sessions of many of the performances and lectures that they had, and they sold those out too. And then, you know, on an even more general scale, you can look at the TV show MythBusters and shows like this. And this is a show that's tremendously popular. These two guys who look at, you know, you can quibble about exactly how rigorous they are in their science, you know, or how much they're dedicated to just blowing things up. But it's unquestionable that they're presenting a scientific approach to the world. where they take some, you know, odd problems that, that people suggest might be possible, and they set out and systematically investigate whether those are possible by, you know, testing them against reality. Right? So there is an audience out there that's willing and interested to consume science if we make the effort of putting it out there for them. So, you know, what am I saying? Am I saying that everyone needs to organize, you know, their own local science festivals? No, but there are some general things that, that we can do that will help bring science to the general public with very little effort. And so what I would argue that, that people in the science community need to do things like essentially supporting the people who bring science to the general public. Right? There are people who write books intended for a general audience about scientists. As scientists, we should help promote those. Right? It's a good thing that people are doing. You should, you know, buy their books and promote their books, write reviews of them, recommend them to people. And we should demand better coverage of science from the media. We should also support science education across the board. And by that, I mean not just hot-button issues. Right? Every now and then, you know, some school board in some podunk county in the United States will you know, change their biology curriculum to start teaching creationism, and people come screaming out of the woodwork to help support biology in that case. Right? However, you know, when those same districts hire English majors to teach math, nobody really notices that. Right? And it does no good to ensure that the biology curriculum is correct if we're not also teaching everything else correctly. We need to support science education across the board in all fields, not just things that are politically charged, and train and support people who will become science teachers. We should encourage our students who are good communicators to, you know, pursue other careers. And, you know, that could be science teachers, or that could be going into other fields entirely. I think it would be terrific if we had more science majors going on for things like law school or careers in politics. Get some people who have a background in science into fields where a scientific approach, scientific knowledge could be really beneficial. And when we have students who have an interest and a talent for communicating to the general public, we need to encourage that interest. Not just say, you know, get back in the lab and do some real work, right? Stop this faffing about doing outreach programs at the university. You know, we need to encourage people who have a talent for this to do that work because it's important for the health of the community. And finally, you know, those of us who are in academia and in a position to hire and evaluate people, we need to reward outreach efforts and make talking to the public a positive feature of tenure and promotion reviews. Right? As people who are in academia know, many times that's actually a negative factor. If you have someone in your department who spends a lot of time doing outreach activities aimed at the general public, that can be seen as a negative thing. That's as taking away time that they should have been spending on doing actual research. All right. That's a very blinkered attitude. That's something that we should try to move beyond and make talking to the public a positive factor. Because ultimately, you know, in the days of Isaac Newton and Robert Hooke and people like that, science was something that wealthy gentlemen could pursue in their spare time. And that's no longer the case today. Right? Today we are highly dependent on public funding for scientific research because things are extremely expensive. All right, so in a, generally speaking, what I would say we need to do is we need to encourage Galileos and not force people into being Newtons. People who are students of science, people who are interested in being scientists, we need to encourage and support those who want to take science to a broader audience and not, you know, channel them through the incentive structure that we have into only talking to a very narrow technical audience. Okay, so that's a very general rant about science and culture and the interactions thereof. What does this have to do with anything about this conference? What I would like to argue is that there are new communications tools provided by the information technology community that, you know, enable us to do communication between science and general society in a much more efficient way. There are tools out there now that enable scientists to reach a global audience and make doing outreach to that audience much easier and relatively painless. Right? And so this is the topic of using weblogs as a tool for public outreach. Right, so if I'm going to talk about weblogs, this is probably redundant for this audience, but I'll mention this just so that everyone's on the same page. There are roughly as many definitions of what a blog is as there are blogs. And so my particular definition is, I would say a blog is a regularly updated personal site maintained by some individual or some smallish group of individuals, at which people post short essays, pictures, links to other things that they find interesting. There's a tagline used by the big blog Boing Boing. They call themselves a directory of wonderful things, which is their particular tagline, but I think it could serve generally, right? A blog is a site at which people point others to things that they find wonderful. And there are, you know, millions of blogs out there. The best-known ones deal with politics or gadgets or gossip, things like that. TPM here is Talking Points Memo. It's a major political blog. Boing Boing talks about gadgets and intellectual property and lots of other things in that vein. Gawker is a celebrity gossip blog. They talk about whatever stupid thing Britney Spears has done most recently. There are also blogs out there that talk about science. And one of these sites that's dedicated to science is scienceblogs.com. This is a group blog, or a collection of blogs sponsored by the Seed Media Group, people who publish Seed Magazine. They have a collection of about 70 blogs covering all areas of science. Here's a screenshot of the front page. If you look at this, you can see life science, physical science, education and careers, medicine and health, brain and behavior. There's all different areas of science represented among the blogs. And science blogs collectively get something like 6 million visits a month. 6 million times a month, somebody comes to science blogs and reads something that was written about science on the site. All right. My own personal blog is at Science Blogs, Uncertain Principles. The tagline I use is physics, politics, and pop culture. I started doing this in 2002, shortly after I was hired at Union, and I moved the site to Science Blogs when Science Blogs launched in early 2006. My personal site gets about 60,000 visits a month. And you know, that may not seem like that many, but I should point out, as I said at the beginning, you know, I teach at Union College, which is a small liberal arts school. Union College has an enrollment of about 2,000 students. Right? 60,000 visits a month is about 2,000 visits a day. So every day, I get about the same number of hits to my website as there are students at my college. So I'm reaching vastly more people through the blog than I possibly could in my day job. This gives you an idea of sort of the broader audience that you can reach. All right, and I do talk, you know, you can tell that I talk about science, right, because there's a graph here. this is a screenshot of a post that I did on, this is part of a series of posts I've been writing, describing for a lay audience, the giving a detailed description of papers on which I'm an author. So this is a graph, it's the key graph from the first paper that I was an author on when I was working on my PhD thesis. You can also see here, there's this little icon, the check mark, says research blogging. This indicates that that post was tagged for researchblogging.org, which is an aggregator that's been put together by Dave Munger, who runs Cognitive Daily, and Sister Edith Bogue, and several other people, to aggregate posts about peer-reviewed journal articles. Right, this is a site, you sign up for it, they give you a little snippet of code that you can embed in your blog, and when you write a post describing a journal article, explaining it for a larger audience, you tag that post, and then this site aggregates them all and presents them in a convenient single location. About 400 different blogs have signed up for this, and they get about 15 posts a day. And something like 300,000 visits a month, or 300,000 times a month, somebody reads an article written about a peer-reviewed journal article that's been aggregated by research blog. So they're really reaching a mass audience. And you can see that this is an international project, because the first thing up here is in German. So they have papers both in German and in English that are aggregated by this. Another initiative in sort of bringing science directly to the general public is there's a series of posts about basic concepts. We started doing this at Science Blogs. Several of us agreed to write blog posts covering sort of the bedrock, most basic concepts in our fields, explained for an absolutely general audience, a high school graduate sort of level. There are now enough of these. Stella John Wilkins collects these and indexes them on his blog. There are now enough of them that he's had to split the list into several different categories. So the screenshot here shows the physics and astronomy one, because this is where my stuff is. So, and ultimately, it's all about me. And so here are a bunch of posts that I wrote about describing the concept of energy, the concept of fields and forces and measurement, and what these ideas mean in the context of physics, as sort of a background for people who are coming to it and may not know the difference between sort of the everyday casual use meaning of force and the physics, what a physicist means when we talk about a force. Right? Those are subtly different things, and that creates some confusion sometimes. And these posts are designed to address that sort of a very basic question. Another thing that science blogs are useful for is debunking bad science. And here I have the banner graphics from a number of sites that are dedicated to responding to kooks, cranks, and charlatans out on the web. These are people who go out and they read articles and they respond to people who have posted distortions of science for personal gain or for political reasons. And this is an important task that these blogs undertake, because the World Wide Web is worldwide and it's open to anyone. You can't prevent anyone from posting distorted science, but you can provide a correction for that. You can make sure that there is correct information out there and that there are responses to the insane things that people put up about their theory of everything, or how to make a perpetual motion machine, or how to cure cancer using tap water. Right. There's people who make money for themselves by posting all manner of quackery, and these sites and others respond to those and I think do a valuable service to the public that way. And then the other thing that people post to science blogs is sort of fluff. This is another screenshot of my blog. This is my daughter, who was 1 month old yesterday, and as you can tell, is the cutest baby in the universe. And this is the other sort of thing that people put up. There's pictures of their kids and their cats and stories about their favorite TV shows and silly little polls and internet quizzes and things. And some people will argue that this is a distraction from the task of bringing science to the public, but I would actually argue that this is a positive feature of science blogs, because it counters the persistent myth that science is something that's done by emotionally stunted nerds. Right, that this putting this out there and showing that scientists are people too. Scientists are, have kids and pets and watch TV and appreciate art and music and so on. That gets the idea out there that scientists are people just like anyone else. And that's very important, particularly for kids who are thinking about, who might be interested in science, but constantly hear that science is something that only nerds do. And feel social pressure to to not go into science because of that sort of reason. And this helps to counter that, I think. And I think that's an underrated effect of science blogging in general. So why blogs in particular? I think blogging as a tool for communicating science to the public offers a number of advantages. Chief among them is it's very easy. I mean, you don't need to know anything about the web, even. There are very simple web-based tools for setting up a blog. There are hosting services that will give you a site for free and do all the work of registering it and that sort of thing. And also, it's a flexible time commitment. It's not something that requires you to sit down and crank out, on demand, 6 hours a day doing this. Right? This is, I maintain my blog. I started my blog shortly after I was hired in an academic job, and I've maintained it through, getting tenure. This is not something that necessarily takes away from having a research career. It's something you can do on a hobby basis. The time I spend maintaining my blog is not time that comes out of time I would spend in the lab. It's time that comes out of time I would spend watching sports on TV or reading books and magazines. Okay, so you can do it on a hobby basis at whatever level you're comfortable with. It has a very large potential audience. I gave some numbers for the numbers of hits. You know, these are huge numbers of people that can be reached by this because your posts are available to the entire world. It's the World Wide Web. Anybody can read them. I get hits from 100 different countries. People are reading my blog. And the other thing that it does that I think is useful is it's excellent writing practice for people who are interested in bringing science to a wider audience. But not only are you directly bringing science to a larger audience, but it gives you a platform to practice the necessary techniques, to learn to write for a general audience, which is a hard thing to do, and to find a voice that works for presenting science to a wider range of people. So I would say blogs are particularly useful both because you can reach a larger audience directly and because they can serve as a springboard for people who are interested in being Galileans and bringing science to a larger audience. People can hone the skills that they need to do this. Okay, what does this have to do with the dog? Because I did start off saying this is about talking to my dog about science. In January of 2007, this is an example to sort of illustrate the points that I'm making about the things that you can do with blogs. And in January of 2007, I wrote a post called Bunnies Made of Cheese, which is an imaginary conversation with my dog. Here's my dog, Emmy, the queen of Niskayuna. And this is an imaginary conversation with my dog about quantum electrodynamics, which I could read to you, but through a chain of events that I'll explain in a minute, somebody else saved me the trouble by doing a dramatic reading of this, and I'll play this audio clip in about 2 minutes.
This is a dramatic reenactment of the Bunnies Made of Cheese posting from Chad Orzil's Uncertain Principles blog. The dog is standing at the window wagging her tail excitedly. I look outside, and the backyard is empty. What are you looking at?
Bunnies made of cheese.
There are no bunnies out there, and there are certainly not any bunnies made of cheese. The backyard is empty.
But particles are created out of empty space all the time, right?
Have you been reading my quantum physics books again?
It's boring here when you're not home. Anyway, answer the question.
Well, yes, in a sense, they're called virtual particles, and the zero-point energy of the vacuum can occasionally manifest as particle and particle pairs.
See? Bunnies made of cheese.
Wagging your tail. Not sure how that helps you. The virtual particles that are created from a vacuum fluctuation have to annihilate a very short time in order to satisfy the energy-time-uncertainty relationship. So like a virtual electron-positron pair lasts something like 10 to the negative 20 seconds before it disappears. They're not real particles.
But they can become real, right? I mean, what about the Hawking radiation?
You're smart for a dog. Well, yeah, in a sense. The idea is that a virtual pair created near the event horizon of a black hole can have one of its members sucked into the black hole, at which point the other particle zips off and becomes real. The energy to account for the mass has to come from somewhere, so the black hole loses a tiny bit of mass.
Bunnies made of cheese.
What?
Look, virtual particles are created all the time, right? Including in our backyard.
Yes, that's right.
Including bunnies, yes.
Technically, it would have to be a bunny anti-bunny pair. Right?
And these bunnies, they could have been cheese.
It's not very likely, but I suppose in a Max Tegmark sort of everything possible must exist kind of universe, and yes, there's a possibility that a bunny anti-bunny pair made of cheese and anti-cheese might be created in the backyard.
And if I eat one, the other becomes real.
Yeah, but they wouldn't last very long before they annihilate.
I'm very fast.
Given the mass of a bunny, they'd only last 10 to the negative 34th seconds, if that.
In that case, you better let me outside so I can catch the bunnies made of cheese.
If you wanted to go outside, why didn't you just say that?
What sort of blog post would that be, anyway? Bunnies made of cheese!
I still don't see any bunnies, but there is a squirrel by the bird feeder.
Ooh, squirrels!
Okay, so that's the bunnies made of cheese post. All right. So this is an example of using the blog to talk about fairly abstract science for a very general audience through the device of talking to the dog. And so I wrote this in January, and it was fairly popular, so I did it again in May. There was another post called Many Worlds, Many Treats. And this one starts off with the dog underneath my desk sniffing around for steak that I dropped in some alternate universe. And it goes on to discuss the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics and decoherence and things like that. This post, this Many Worlds, Many Treats, was linked to by Boing Boing and picked up by the aggregating site Dig. And the weekend it was posted, more than 50,000 people read it, which is, you know, a gigantic audience. And one of those people was an agent who contacted me and said, this would be a great idea for a book, which my initial reaction was, huh? But they convinced me of this. I wrote a book proposal, and this was bought by Scribner. And so I've now written a popular audience book on quantum physics, explaining quantum theory through a mixture of imaginary conversations with my dog and more straightforward explanations for humans. And this should be published sometime early next year. So this is an extreme example, but it illustrates sort of the general principle of how you can use the idea of blogs and the platform provided by blogs to promote science, even very abstract science, to a wide audience, and to produce new and completely unexpected opportunities for outreach to that sort of broad audience. I'd like to mention some other projects and things that go on. Numerous books and articles have been spun out of weblogs. Lots of people have had posts reprinted in other places. There are some books. My colleague Janet Stemwedel is another person on science blogs, has a book project that grew out of her blog. There have been a couple of collections published of the best writing on science weblogs, edited by Bora Zivkovic, under the name The Open Laboratory. We've done some, you know, direct outreach for educational things at science blogs. We've run two fundraisers the last 2 years. For this educational charity called Donors Choose. We've raised over $88,000 to buy supplies and demo equipment for people in poor school districts. There's a lot of interesting things that you can do in terms of interactivity. We've run some polls and things. Early in the science blogs, I ran a series of posts on the greatest experiment in physics and polled the audience on that. I'm currently working with a number of other people on putting together a sort of top 100 popular science books list to, you know, serve as a resource. And you can also do some experiments. You can actually do some science or something close to science through the blog medium. Dave Munger does, at a blog called Cognitive Daily, does what he calls Casual Fridays. Every Friday he posts a little psych experiment. In the form of a poll that, you know, people can click on, answer, you know, watch a short video, answer some questions, and then he analyzes the results and explains what they tell us about you know, human nature. And there's more to come. I'm sure that right now there are very smart people out there somewhere thinking of some new and novel way to use blogs to promote science that, you know, I haven't listed here. So this is sort of my evangelical argument that scientists should be writing blogs, and that this serves as a powerful tool to reach out to a broad audience. And I would say that there's, you know, I would like to see more of this, but there are some encouraging signs in terms of getting institutions to pick up on this. In 2005, for the World Year of Physics, Symmetry Magazine, a particle physics publication, ran this project called Quantum Diaries, where they had 30-some physicists keep update weblogs through the course of the year, talking about what they do. More recently, with the Large Hadron Collider coming online, institutions in the U.S. that are affiliated with the LHC have launched this U.S. LHC blog site. And so we're starting to see some institutional blogs, people using this on sort of making a concerted effort from the scientific community to, you know, use the power of blogs to reach out and promote interesting science. So far, this has mostly been in the high-energy physics community, I think possibly because they got burned so badly with the superconducting super collider that they've really learned the importance of reaching out to a wider public and building some constituency. But this is starting to be more general. The American Physical Society maintains a site called Physics Central that now includes a sort of general interest physics news blog. And so people are starting to catch on to the power of this, but I think there's still more to be done. So I would like to see you know, thousands more blogs written by scientists, because I think this is a very valuable way of reaching out to the general public. And so that's the end of my presentation. I'll stop there. And I've used up almost all of my time, but I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has.
idea gives us lots of ideas to work with. I would just add the science festivals thing. I think it's a really great thing. In Australia for, I don't know, 20 years they've had, or more they've had, like annual science festivals. With the thing that, Brian did, he wants to see the science festival go across America, and many countries have annual science festivals. It gets this sort of thing where almost all year, then the high schools and people, they start preparing for it and start going into it, and then it becomes a really, really exciting public thing and keeps people's interest.
Yeah, I think that's a great sign. I hope they, I don't know if they've, you know, locked down that they're definitely doing it again next year.
Yeah,
but I definitely hope to see it.
Different cities, different states already.
Yeah, last year it happened to line up, it fell during the same week as the annual research conference that I go to, so I went to that instead. But I would definitely like to see more of that and you know, attend those.
Sabina mentioned this in her talk. She was talking about the balance between different commitments. You could potentially end up with a situation where scientists are expected to keep blogs in addition to teaching and doing service and blah, 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 blah. You know, basically the question I'm asking is, you know, what's an appropriate level of commitment from the scientific community as a whole, and how do you ensure that that's actually what comes about?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I don't want to see a situation where absolutely every scientist is expected to keep a blog. I think that would actually be a disaster, because there are a lot of people who are outstanding scientists who would be terrible bloggers, who just have no ability to connect with the public. And there are people who are good at this, and there are people who aren't. And I think what I would like to see is more of it's not so much more requirements on, you know, more demands on people's time, but more of a recognition that you know, people who have a talent in this direction or have an inclination to reach out and to connect with the general public, that they should be supported and rewarded for doing that. And so I wouldn't like to see it become, you know, a fourth, you know, teaching research service blog as part of your career evaluation, because, you know, shoot me now. But you know, I would like to see it be an option and it be something that people can do if they have the skills and the inclination.
Just real quickly, you provided a lot of data regarding NSF funds for research. I would be interested in, if you have or have not done so, but your sort of personal critique of NSF's activities to date, which could be categorized under what you would like to see, not just blogging, but that support public understanding.
I haven't looked at it that much. I know, you know, NSF grants now, you're expected to, as part of the application process, explain how you're going to, you know, benefit larger society, which, you know, blogs could serve as that sort of component of things. I think, at least in the grants I've reviewed, people's approach to that has been remarkably half-assed. And so, you know, they sort of tend to say, well, we'll train some graduate students and some of them will go become teachers. And that's not, you know, I would like to see that improve, and I'd like to see them demand more from that. But I haven't really looked systematically at what the NSF does in terms of outreach.
Yeah, that was actually going to be what I was going to mention, that just about every grant I've seen in the past however many years has had a public outreach component. It's pretty much a requirement. And for the most part, what most people put down is sort of half-assed, you know, not very serious. And, you know, saying, oh, I'm going to write a blog is probably much more realistic and much more useful as public outreach than what most people put down. Whether or not it's recognized as such is another story, but it in fact is probably much more useful.
Yeah, I'd like to see more of that,
right?
Less, you know, some of our students will be teachers.
Can you give a sense of the practice of your readers or science blog readers in general, whether it was like grad students or the public?
To a large degree, the people who read, I have an information sheet somewhere of a sort of detailed demographic breakdown of people who read science blogs. They've done a number of surveys of this. It tends to be a very highly educated audience that is our regular audience, or at least that fraction of our audience is willing to spend 10 minutes completing a little survey form. And so most of them are mostly college graduates, mostly people who are interested in science at the beginning. But one of the nice things about the blog medium, though, again, because it's out there on the World Wide Web, is you have the opportunity to sort of serendipitously reach people who don't know that they're interested in reading blogs by scientists. The majority of our regular readers are people who are inclined to be interested in science anyway. But we pick up people, you know, from things like, you know, I got linked by Boing Boing. People who, you know, normally go to Boing Boing to, you know, look at pictures of bacon taped to cats, that sort of thing. Those people get directed to science blogs occasionally, and some of them stick. And every now and then I've asked, you know, who are you to my readers, and I'm surprised at the variety of people that. You know, people who are English teachers or freelance writers or artists. There's a surprising variety of people that you end up reaching. Yeah.
You mentioned the Galilean talk location. You both three people, and I think that's also true. The funny part of so you're gonna get another job, or you're gonna get a cat.
Well, I have a baby now. So. In a few years, we'll have a three-way conversation with me, the dog, and the kid. in the book as it's written, it's sort of me. The dog keeps coming up with harebrained schemes to find a state in alternate universes. No, it's not how it works. So.
Yeah, 2 points. We had the good fortune of having the head of NSF as our keynote speaker at our. University spring retreat, and I can't name specific programs, but the NSF is very much involved with public education of science, supporting a variety of programs, as well as undergraduate research initiatives. Second point is that I think what you have outlined here is an extension of an existing paradigm. That in fact concern seems to be about what portion of our jobs will or will not be devoted to these additional activities, as opposed to rethinking what our role should be, how we should be engaged with the public, how the public should be engaged with us.
Yeah, I think to some degree I am arguing for sort of a back to the future sort of approach. And if you look, 100 years ago, there was a NOVA program recently on the absolute quest to reach absolute zero. And one of the most astounding things that I learned in it was that 100 years ago, Sir James Dewar regularly spoke to audiences of hundreds of people every Saturday night. He gave scientific lectures, and they were packed. The eminent scientists used to do a lot more of addressing the general public directly than I think they do now. I think it's always been a part of the job to communicate to the general public, but I think relatively recently it's become a smaller and smaller part of the job, and not so much the thing that eminent people are expected to do. It's something that's done by sort of marginal people or people who are past their prime.
Yeah, we have given that responsibility over to a third party. Mm-hmm. When in fact, my argument is that it should be an integral part of what we do as educators, as scientists, as researchers.
Yeah.
That the public should be part of the experience.
Yeah, and that's what I would like to see more. I absolutely agree that there should be more communication with the public about research as a problem.
Well, in my institution, one of the interesting kind of things that I'm trying to get going is to try and convince, because this the Faculty of Science and Engineering they have communications people, they have research officers, but they're kind of key, they're kind of keyed into the press release thing, which if they do 100 press releases,
five of them will get picked up
right.
by newspapers. And, you know, to try and tell them, well, why don't you blog?
Yeah,
and then, or, you know. The same work, you're doing the same work, but people can actually, you know, they'd have to write them a little bit differently, but it's essentially kind of a similar work.
There's actually, there's a site called Eureka Alert, it's .com or .org, that is basically an RSS feed of press releases from, you know, they get press releases from all sorts of universities and research labs and things, and sort of just put those up on the web. So I do, you know, periodically little posts about recent physics news or just like link stumps, that, and that's my main source for that information. Is press releases that, you know, you can now get, those can now get to the public through channels other than, you know, the 1 in 100 that gets picked up by the New York Times when it happens to be a slow news day and they need something to fill a few column inches. So more can be done with that. And it would really be helpful if a lot of those press releases were better written or more suited to blog publication.
Well, because then they would be the same. They would spend the same time, but they would have something that was more accessible.
Yeah, absolutely.
So just to follow up very quickly, the reason I asked about the NSF funding activity is the whole thing about, well, if there, you know, there's resource constraints, so how about determining what's really effective? Mm-hmm. And is it a question of, you know, these sort of, I tend to think many of the NSF programs are kind of top-down versus more grassroots or bottom-up. So it's just a point.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. And this discussion reminds me of something else that I heard about recently, which was NASA, a guy named Mike Brotherton, got NASA to fund a workshop for science fiction writers. So they ran a program, a sort of a week-long crash course in an intensive workshop on the basics of modern astronomy for people who are science fiction writers, with the idea being that these are people who will take that knowledge and go out and write rip-roaring tales that will sell lots of books and get kids hooked on the idea of science, you know, with better science in it, and that's sort of a channel that you can reach a large number of people, which I think is a tremendously neat idea. Doing that, they did that for astronomy. It would be interesting to see if you could get NSF or somebody to do that for quantum physics and that sort of thing. I think, you know, exploring those sorts of other channels is a valuable thing that could be done.
Yeah, just wanted to do a quick follow-on comment. You talked about the Eureka Alerts, and so I'm here as a consultant to the U.S. Department of Energy. And one of their big sites, science.gov, is about to come up with a new version that is going to be integrated with Alert. So, you know, we're very much interested in the public getting, you know, access to scientific information that's going to be of interest to them.
So that's great to hear. More of that.
Okay, brief addition. Most of you may know next year's International Year of Astronomy, United Nations. Mm-hmm. And they've got blogging.
Good. So I think we have
question. At the University of Maryland Physics Department, they've actually, if you become a PhD student or postdoc, you now have to go and maintain pages on Wikipedia related to the research that you're going to do there. So it's another way of making sure accurate science information.
That'd be good. It'd be good to. It's amazing how many science-related pages on Wikipedia are badly plagiarized from other sources, or just bad.
Some would be improved if they were
plagiarized.
Okay. On that note, I wonder if you blog about this conference, could you please send me a link so I can collect it? Then I'd say we make a lunch.